Hello there, everybody. This is just a quick note. We had some technical difficulties while we were recording this, so the sound quality isn't quite as good as some of the other podcasts. So just wanted to make you aware of that, but the content's great. This NFL players' health study is really interesting. So apologies for sound quality, but I think you're gonna enjoy this. So thanks. Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Chris Dubert, a senior law and ethics associate for the Law and Ethics Initiative of the Football Players Health Study at Harvard University. Previously, he practiced commercial litigation, sports law, securities litigation, and labor and employment litigation in New York City. He also does research on behalf of the Sports Lawyers Association. He graduated with a joint JD/MBA degree from Fordham University School of Law and the Graduate School of Business in 2010, and a BS in sports management from the University of Massachusetts in 2006. So that's a little bit of a bio. Glad to have you here with us today, Chris.
Thank you for having me on.
I guess that's kind of your resume, but is there anything else you want to say about yourself before we get started so we can better get to know you?
Sure. I guess just some relevant background information is I've been fortunate now to be working with NFL players for about 10 years. After getting my undergraduate degree in sport management, I went to law school in New York and I started working there with Sports Stars, which is one of the larger player representation firms. They have about 100 NFL player clients and got to see the whole side of that business, sports and all. Also got to do some statistical work, contract work, things like that. Did an internship with Jets and then sort of parlayed that into the first 4 years of my practice in New York, where we did a lot of representing players when they would get disciplined by the commissioner and failed drug tests, steroid tests, things like that. And that led me to join this project at Harvard.
Well, yeah, sounds like you have a wide-ranging experience. And now it seems your work is research-focused. You're not an actively practicing lawyer. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, I wasn't a practicing attorney in Massachusetts, although I have since become one. But yeah, this was about, I had done a fair amount of academic publication in law school and during my early years of practice. And this was a chance to really full-time focus on some of the issues that I thought were interesting and had come up in my representation of the player.
Well, great. Yeah, thanks for that background. Why don't we get started and talk about the main topic of this podcast, which is this football players' health study at Harvard University. The full title is Protecting and Promoting the Health of NFL Players, Legal and Ethical Analysis and Recommendations. It was published in November 2016, and I'll link to it in the notes to this podcast episode so people can read it. It's all accessible online, and you can get a hard copy, and it's quite an impressive tome. It's 491 pages. So could you just give us a kind of a brief summary of what exactly this study is and what you all were trying to accomplish in working on it?
Sure. I'll provide some background of the study and then where this report came in. So the 2011 collective bargaining agreement between the NFL and NFLPA set aside money for research on player health issues. Ultimately, the NFLPA, they went out and did a request for proposals from various universities about researching player health issues, and ultimately in 2014 reached an agreement with Harvard to create the Football Players Health Study. So the Football Players Health Study started, in this really about February 2014. It includes a large portion at the medical school, which is doing some really interesting, groundbreaking medical research. The nature of medical research is it takes a little longer. So my portion that I joined was the law and ethics portion. And our goal was to study legal and ethical issues that affect NFL player health, and then to make appropriate recommendations. The part that I'm a part of, I joined what's known here as the Petrie-Flom Center at Harvard Law School, which studies bioethics and other medical and health-related issues. And so we really got to the people I work with, Holly Lynch and Glenn Cohen, who's a professor at the law school. It's a really great pairing because they have an expertise in those issues, and I have an expertise in sports law. So together we had a variety of projects we started working on. And just I'll pause there for a second. It's important to point out that although the NFLPA is the contracted funder or guarantor of the arrangement and the study, they don't have the ability to control our research in any way. It's very important to us throughout that we treat the NFL and NFLPA and all the other stakeholders. So ultimately, this report, Protecting and Promoting, became sort of the cornerstone of our work, which was to look at 20 different stakeholders, and we went through a process to identify which stakeholders we felt were relevant and then how important they were, and understanding their legal and ethical obligations in player health, what is actually happening, current practices, and then to make recommendations. We ultimately make 76 recommendations, and we understand it is certainly quite lengthy. We tried to break it down into a variety of ways to make it digestible both to the public and also to players.
So you brought together a kind of an interdisciplinary study and looked at it from all these different perspectives. The title is that it's looking at the health of NFL players. I think most listeners to this podcast will be familiar with concussion issues and things like that. Is that what is the focus of this, or are there other parts of health that this study looks at as well?
Yeah, that's an important question. And the Football Players Health Study, in fact, is, although concussions are certainly a very important topic, the Football Players Health Study has a much broader focus, which is looking at the whole player for his whole lifetime. And so even as the medical school side, they're focusing on, they've done some really fascinating research on ACLs and cardiovascular disease, as well as concussions. But in us too, we defined health quite broadly. There's a variety of things sort of known as the social determinants of health, and financial health and mental health and your social health with your family and friends. All those things are interrelated and affect each other in important ways. And so, some people might call it health and well-being. And for shorthand, I think, our definition uses health, but we wanted to look at all the different things that affect the quality of a player's life, both while playing and after.
Okay. And then you come up with some recommendations about how to improve that. So we'll get into that a little bit later. But just as I was looking through the report, and I haven't read the whole thing cover to cover, but you all did make an accessible, executive summary, and there's the key recommendations and things like that. One thing that I think is particularly interesting about this is how, as you said, you look at it from the perspective of different stakeholders, 20 in total, and all of these have some interest in player health, and they might be different interests. I mean, I think some of the main ones are the players themselves, the medical teams, the NFL, the Players Association, clubs, individual employees of the clubs, which might have different interests than the clubs themselves, and player advisors, things like that. So I don't know, was there anything that as you were working on this report that you found to be particularly interesting about how the different stakeholders have interests in the health of NFL players?
Well, it was definitely very interesting to go through the different stakeholders and learn more about them. And through that process, we try to engage organizations from these industries or individuals in these organizations to better understand their practices. And for example, the equipment manufacturing industry has been involved in the lawsuits and has certainly been alleged to have been a part of the wrongdoing that has led to players having issues related to concussions. But we learned a lot about NOCSI, which is the National Operating Committee on Sports Athletic Equipment, and talked to people from Riddell and Schutt, and learned interesting things about certainly what they've done and what they're trying to do. And we ultimately didn't have recommendations for them because they are seemingly doing the best that they can, and it's in their best interest for a variety of reasons. I think otherwise, I came in with a perspective of having worked with a lot of contract advisors, better known as agents, and also financial advisors. And people may not fully realize the role they play in players' lives. And to me, those are industries that are in need of substantial changes. And so that's an area that I sort of wanted to, not necessarily focus on, but wanted to bring my expertise to. And I think in talking with contract advisors, financial advisors, which we also did interview, and their quotes are included in the report, I think that they, too, believe that there could be important changes to their industry.
Okay. And you noted that these advisors in particular have some things that they could change. What were some of the issues that you noticed related to the advisors? Is it kind of a long-term, short-term, the interests diverge between them and players, or what stuck out to you there?
The biggest issue, and this is can be kind of controversial, but it's the practice of contract advisors and financial advisors do this as well, providing prospective clients, and I'll give sort of an example walkthroughs factually, providing them with significant sums of money to become clients. So what often happens is players, as they're entering their senior season or junior season, whenever they start being draft eligible, that's when agents and financial advisors start recruiting them. And that's a messy process where, the better you are, you can get dozens of phone calls from different people, and can be really quite relentless and overwhelming. And so the agents and financial advisors, but it's common practice, hasn't been for a long time, that agents pay for players, their players, when they ultimately do sign them as clients to prepare for the combine. And training is expensive, you know, somewhere in the area of $30,000-$35,000, and then housing them and providing them loans and things like that. But better players also often get marketing advances and other loans that can easily be $100,000 or more. And oftentimes the conditions of these loans are that they don't have to be repaid if the player retains the agent as a client for a certain period of time. And as a result, what's certainly happened is many contract advisors are providing what are called loans to players, but they're advances and essentially payments, inducements to obtain the player as a client. It's a practice with a lot of agents. I was involved in grievances where agents tried to recover these payments, player fired the agent, and also was involved in situations where agents thought players had been stolen from them wrongfully because of certain types of inducements. The bottom line is certainly a concern that players are choosing agents and financial advisors not based on who is their best advocate, but by who's giving them the most money. It's a short-sighted approach, and a lot of the players we spoke with also agree that it ends up, it's a bad situation that often puts players in trouble, you know, right from the start in terms of whether they might owe money later at a certain time or whether they're stuck to a financial advisor or an agent that isn't maybe the most competent.
Okay. And yeah, like you said, obviously that's a situation that's been around for a while. What kind of suggestions did you have to fix that?
Yeah. So what we would like to see done is from the agents, we think there should be a prohibition against providing loans and advances in excess of the cost reasonable and necessary to prepare for the NFL draft. And that can increase with inflation or by some nominal amount every year. But there's no reason why we think players need to be provided with these loans that are just sort of forgiven. If it costs $35,000 to have the player prepare for the combine and his pro day workouts, that's fine. They'll let the agent pay for that. But anything beyond that starts becoming troubling inducements. And financial advisors, similarly, they should be straight up prohibited from providing those types of inducements for them to become the financial advisor's clients.
Well, yeah, no, that's interesting. And I think the NFLPA has been involved as well, in particularly with the financial advisors, as far as, you know, getting them to meet certain qualifications and certifications and things like that. So, yeah, it sounds like maybe there's some stuff already moving on that.
Yeah, that's the NFLPA certainly deserves credit because for about 15 years, they're the only union that does regulate or register their financial advisors. And there's a distinction here in that the agents are certified by the union pursuant to the National Labor Relations Act, whereas because the union has the authority to really negotiate all player contracts themselves, but nonetheless delegates that duty to agents. Financial advisors don't fall within the same purview of the labor laws, but nonetheless, the NFLPA has a registration system, which has tried to set some minimum qualifications. But a problem is that there's nothing requiring players to use registered financial advisors. Many players do not. So many players are using financial advisors that have not been vetted by the NFL, and they might not even know it. So I also think there's more that could be done to make sure players are using financial advisors that are vetted by the NFL. And the NFLPA, you know, as we talked about before, there are probably things that we think they could do to increase their oversight over the financial advisor industry, including amending some of the financial advisor regulations.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for filling us in with that information. Another ethical issue that I've noticed in both the report and just kind of in watching football is the role of team doctors and things like that, because they, you know, whether they're employed by the team, and, you know, there might be pressures there to say that players are ready that might not be ready and things like that. Did your report find anything interesting there?
Yeah, we can discuss what we found or whether anything changed, but I think you sort of hit on the head, and this was a focus of our report, which is on its face, we believe there is an inherent structural conflict of interest in having doctors that both treat players and also have obligations and report to the club. What you find beyond that is certainly interesting and speak to the severity of the conflict. But on its face, we definitely think that there is a conflict, and there are ways of minimizing that conflict. And we make a very lengthy recommendation for doing so. And it's challenging to try and sum up in any short time, because we try to take into consideration all the logistical complexities, as well as the clubs as their right to player information. As employers, they are entitled to a certain amount of information about their employees' ability to do the job that they've been attracted to do. Nevertheless, we still think it's best and most ethically appropriate to provide players with doctors that have players' interests as their exclusive, just like any of us do when we go to a doctor.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, when I go to the doctor, I don't go to my employer's doctor. You know, and you know, an employer's doctor perhaps could, but like you said, on the face of it, there's a potential for conflict there. So.
Yeah, and it's important to clarify, you know, we don't mean, and we certainly aren't casting aspersions on the club doctors. They are undoubtedly extremely qualified and among the best in sports doctors in the country. But nevertheless, their trust is an important part of the doctor-patient relationship. And players we've talked to, and there's been other data out there, suggest nonetheless that the arrangement does contribute to a level of distrust between the doctors and the players. And so its relationship to the doctors really shouldn't want either. And so even if the doctors are great doctors, the situation sets them up not necessarily for failure, but it creates one that is extremely challenging to them and can be changed.
Yeah, no, I think that's great to point that out. I guess as we're getting ready to start wrapping up here, and you know, we don't have time to discuss everything or even a lot of what's in the report. Like you said, you provide this list of recommendations. What are some of the top recommendations that you think are kind of key things that should be done in order to improve the health of football players?
Yeah, so certainly the big thing we focused on was trying to restructure the conflict of the club medical staff, like we said. Some of the other things that we wanted to focus on, there are simple things like the fact that the unaffiliated neurotrauma consultant who is on the sideline for NFL games and who's part of the concussion protocol, examines players but doesn't have the ability to remove a player from the game. And we have no reason to believe, and in fact, I think we've seen data that says there's never been a conflict, that no UNC has ever said a player has to come out and the club doctor says they have to stay in. Nevertheless, it seems something that should easily err on the side of caution to remove players from the game. There are other ways in which we think players on the concussion issue, we recommend a concussion-specific injured reserve list. And this is something that is really derived from Major League Baseball, because they now have a 10-day disabled list and their 60-day disabled list, a 25-day disabled list, but they also have a 7-day concussion-specific injury list. And part of that is that concussions are challenging to diagnose and treat. And typical concussion recovery time is somewhere in the 7 to 10 day range, and that happens to be the exact amount of time between one NFL game and the next. And so it creates roster pressures. And while the NFL has a 53-man inactive roster, only 46 guys are active each week. So there is this 7-man buffer of inactive players that could be used for concussed players. Nevertheless, players are still always under pressure to get off that list one way or another. Be active again, or they're being cut, so the club can replace them. So we think it'd be beneficial to create a concussion-specific list to remove players from that sort of 53-46 quandary that happens each week. One of the things we want to focus on is enabling players, providing them with information so that they can make informed decisions about their careers and whether to continue playing and for how long to play. And what's been disappointing is the NFL and NFLPA, they receive data about player injuries at the end of each season, but to our knowledge, they are not making all of that information publicly available. And we've recommended they do that because we think it's very important that players have all the necessary data information in considering their health and their career choices.
Yeah, no, I think that should be available to players, you know, obviously. You know, the way we talk about a lot of this stuff, whether it's money or health or something, it's almost like it's something that happens to the players and that they're not involved in. And I think, yeah, I mean, we empower these people. They're adults. They can make decisions. But they, you know, in order to make good decisions, you need to be empowered to have the information to be able to analyze the situation. And so, yeah, I certainly think there's no reason why they shouldn't be provided that information as well.
Sure. And I would just say generally, I mean, I know fans, I think you might have mentioned the fans being a chapter here too, which is that I've had the pleasure of working with these players and getting to know a variety of players over my career. And they're often a diverse and interesting groups of people. And so the fans might not always appreciate or think of them as people. And so the more opportunity people have to understand that and the more sympathy I think you might have, more understanding of how players might approach their career.
Okay. Yeah. No. Yeah. That's. I think that's right. Okay. So as we're finishing up here, this study's been produced. I guess the question is, what's in the future? Is this kind of something that you just circulate to people and hope that it makes a difference, or what's the future going forward with this study?
Sure. So actually, last month we had a law review article come out in the University of Pennsylvania Law Review, which was looking at the application of the Americans with Disabilities Act and Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act to the NFL workplace. And that, it's a complicated issue. And we try the genesis of that project was related to a lot of new wearable technologies that are increasingly being used in professional sports. The main takeaway from that article was that we are concerned that the medical exams at the NFL Combine, which actually started today, might violate the Americans with Disabilities Act. So that was just one other work. We have another report that will be coming out in May that looks at compares the policies and practices of the different leagues on health issues. We'll have some other work coming out, but we're certainly, our focus now is getting a conversation started, making people aware of our work, and then seeing where it goes.
Okay. So yeah, and we here at the Sports Lobbyist podcast will be watching too. I think it's a really helpful addition to the conversation about the health of NFL players. So I'm glad that you and the people there at Harvard are doing what you do. So yeah. So thanks for taking the time out of your day to record this podcast. I don't know if there's anything else you want to say before we close.
No, I appreciate you taking the time and giving the opportunity to let us talk about our work a little bit.
Okay. Well, great. Yeah. Thanks for coming on the Sports Lobbyist podcast, and we'll stay tuned to hear what else comes out of this project.
Great. Thank you.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIB Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, @PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, @SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.